Unser Sonderangebot auf Radio Lora 97,5 MHz. Jede Woche am Samstag und am Mittwoch. Jede Woche eine andere Sendung extra für euch ausgewählt. Heute hört ihr eine Sendung auf Englisch zum Thema Islam und Anarchismus. Fast 2 Stunden lang sprechen Scott und Mohammed über Mohammeds Erfahrungen mit dem Aufstand auf dem Tahrirplatz 2011 und die westliche Medienberichterstattung darüber, aktuelle Unruhen im Iran, Orientalismus, dekoloniale Bildung, Islam, Siedlerkolonialismus, Anarchismus und vieles mehr. Die Sendung ist auf Englisch, leider nicht ganz komplett, weil sie so lange war und wurde von Final Straw Radio produziert.
Airing first on Asheville FM, WSFM LP 103.3 in Asheville, this is the Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian radio show broadcasting out of occupied Soligi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world.
So I'm very excited to be talking with Mohammed Abdu, the author of the recent Pluto Press book, Islam and Anarchism, Relationships and Resonances, which I think is an incredibly important contribution. And Mohammed, would you introduce yourself with your pronouns and any affiliations or connections that you would like to name?
Assalamu alaikum, Scott. Thank you very much for having me. I'm going to speak to you today, and assalamu alaikum to our audience. Insofar as my pronouns, he, they, them, him. Insofar as a little bit of background with regards to myself, I'm a postdoctoral fellow at Cornell University and a visiting scholar and an assistant professor of sociology at the American University of Cairo. Self-identifying Muslim anarchist and settler of color of North African and Arab descent. I'm a scholar activist. I've been involved in movements post-Seattle 1999, the anti-globalization movements, as well as Tahrir with the Zapatistas, indigenous struggles like the Mohawks of Tantanega during the struggle over the Culberstone Track. And yeah, a lot of movements working towards Palestinian liberation, BIPOC liberation, certainly anti-statist liberation and anti-capitalist, certainly, but definitely anti-statist.
Great, thank you. And yeah, so I'm so glad to talk with you. And going off of that experience, I thought maybe we could sort of frame our discussion, since reading the book, especially towards the end of the book, it seems like a lot of the reflections were spurred on from your experience, you know, during the so-called Arab Spring and in Tahrir Square. And then, you know, currently we're in this moment with uprising in Iran. And I was wondering if you could describe some of the lessons you drew from the momentum that was going on at first, and then how it ultimately failed, and maybe like what lessons still haven't been learned, and how we sort of see the media repeating some of the same narratives.
Thank you. That's a very important question, simply because of the reproduction of errors, mistakes, Orientalism. And given the topic of the book, you know, after all, I wrote the book with the sense that language is neither in a certain sense informational nor communicational, as I said, you know, in a talk recently. And I'm very Deleuzean in the sense that the point of language is something else. It's order words. And I don't mean that in an authoritarian sense, but in an action-based sense, either from one statement to another. Tahrir is, you can imagine, perhaps the last chapter was quite triggering. It remains very much triggering, simply because there's a difference between the way that revolutions happen historically in people's revolutionary becomings. What happens to people when they rise up emotionally, physically, mentally? How do they reconceive intimacy? Who's going to pick up the garbage? What are you going to do with a nuclear power plant? What are you going to do with the army when somebody gets sick? So they involve real practical questions. And that I learned offhand very early on from the experience with the Zapatistas. There are 3 things that are necessary for a revolution to really be called a revolution, or for a revolutionary movement to refer to itself as a revolutionary movement. Number one, you need to have decolonized education, knowledge production, whatever the medium that manifests within. It could be books, it could be literature, it could be talks, oral histories, and so on and so forth, arts, zines, and so on and so forth. A plethora of different forms of knowledge production, because you're replacing the elements of modern coloniality with a completely different paradigm of reference in a revolutionary sense, in such a way that people transform in and of themselves. The Quran, and Muslims know this quite well, has the verse, and they repeat this verse at every almost Friday prayers, in the lalay rayumabukum and hatay rumbi erfusim. God does not change a people until they change in and of themselves. So it is a matter of the greater jihad, the jihad and the struggle against one's own inner microfascisms, my patriarchy that I have to contend with every single day of my life. I have to learn to listen to women, not just hearing them, as in preparing a response, a reactionary response to what that has just been said, given the asymmetries of power that exists between me and somebody else. And that's change, transformation of oneself, more so than quote unquote institutions or the removal of a despot. Mubarak was not an autocrat. That is to suggest that Mubarak had complete and utter control and full power. Mubarak depicted himself as God, a pharaoh. Indeed, he was. But that does not mean that, and this is the nuance that comes about with words in the Orwellian world that we live in right now, in which, you know, liberalism both stole the words and their meanings. There is no such thing as an autocrat because we always have agents. Egyptians participated in the facade within Tahrir, before Tahrir, and following Tahrir. Sexual harassment, anti-blackness, nepotism, rushwa, all kinds of factors, of dimensions. There was no alternative project that the so-called masses have. We have to understand that these masses were wide, they were diverse. You had the hijabi, you had the chain-smoking niqabi woman, you had the liberal woman, you had anarchists, certainly, the Marxist-Leninist revolutionary socialist, referred to as the Strafiyin, Ithawriyin. You had, of course, the Muslim Brotherhood. You have other forms of Islamists, insofar as Salafis, and so on and so forth. You had the Nasserites. You had the Sabbatists. Of course, you had the liberals, and so on and so forth. There were no discussions amongst these different factions with regards to what tomorrow was going to bring, insofar as how we were going to bring about a pluriverse world, or if we were remotely interested in that. There were no discussions of the ethics of disagreements, insofar as what bound the millions of folks that were in Tahrir together, let alone what distinguished them insofar as apart. People were merely engaged, and this is part of, unfortunately, the inferiority complex, the psychoaffective phenomenon and violence that we internalized in reactionary ways. Now, granted, we're in the heat of the battle, and when you're fighting police forces, the army, we burnt 99 police stations. So much for a nonviolent revolution. And of course, you know, we had sent a letter. Comrades of Cairo actually had written a letter to Occupy Wall Street insofar as the facade of nonviolence, because it's quite desecrating and insulting that over 1,000 people die, are martyrs, that we have yet to honor because we have yet to fulfill their dreams or see through their dreams. And assume that this was a nonviolent revolution. Of course, it was not a Twitter revolution, as, you know, it's orientally depicted within Euro-American media and so on, conservative, liberal, and so on and so forth, either. We had to go knock door to door because the internet was cut out. We had to establish our own community councils. Women were, quote unquote, manning checkpoints. So we see a breakdown of gender relations. Queer folks engaged in a pride march, and so on and so forth. So the potential was there, and so far as social transformation and change, for the first time in Egypt's history, youth were bringing cleaning materials from their households and literally getting on their hands and knees and scrubbing the Tahrir. There was a sense of ownership of space, or a sense of belonging to space. It ruptured space and time, galvanized the world. But unfortunately, there were a lot of projections that fed into the middle to upper class English-speaking so-called revolutionaries, that really most of which had no experience insofar as grassroots organizing or the intellectual base from which to think through what are we going to do tomorrow. Egypt is complicit in the occupation of Gaza, the largest concentration camp in the world by air, land, and sea. All these geopolitical factors, these local factors, these regional factors, the assumption that we would just be allowed to do whatever it is that we wanted to do was obviously an illusion. And in so many ways, I lost my voice speaking in Tahrir, that shi'arat, that the slogans, as is occurring in Iran, of freedom, of aish huriya adal iktima'i, aish bread, huriya, freedom, social justice, adal iktima'i. What kind of social justice are we talking about here? How do you bring it about? What kind of freedom? What kind of bread? Because you ask two people and you won't get the same response. What exactly are we talking about here? Where is the strategic revolutionary plan? Now, we can't plan uprisings as much as we can prepare for them. The Zapatistas have a saying, holding each other's hands, we teach one another what each of us knows. But arrogance plays too much of a role and plays too much of a role, again, for the reason that people are not willing to combat their inner micro-fascisms. People are caught within their so-called ideological silos, although I don't believe that ideologies exist. So as I noted, the first thing that was missing is decolonized knowledge education. Number two, the construction of alternatives. Alternative egalitarian schools, hospitals, and talking free breakfast programs to Panthers, and so on and so forth. And the third is being prepared to self-defend those initiatives. Now, it's not that initiatives did not arise out of Tahrir, of course. Meta Master is a great initiative. I interviewed members of initiatives insofar as queer feminists, knowledge production sites, and so on and so forth, social centers. But the permanency was not long-lasting, given the jury, we're talking now over 10 years, and the chipping away gradually, let alone the reconstruction and reassertion of space vis-a-vis the state and its collusion with, obviously, neoliberal capital. And what ties both together is the racial dimension, because as we know, or as Piccolo had noted, that all states are racist, and as Cedric Robinson and a lot of Black feminists and scholars have taught, including Ruthie Gilmore Wilson, Marian Caba, and so on, that capitalism is racist. It is inherently racial. So that is the dilemma of, in a certain sense, of Tahrir. The construction of Egyptian identity, nationality, patriotism, nationalism is what united Egyptian people within itself. And there was nothing beyond that. Down with the regicide, Mubarak. Where is the regicide that exists inside each and every single one of us? That becomes the question. So when we look at Iran now and the manifestation of what is going on in Iran, let us also decipher and discern the geopolitical moment in which we are living. 2 weeks prior, or about even a week to 10 days prior to these events, we had Ayatollah Khamenei, ostensibly a lot of rumors, particularly within your American media, claiming that he's quite ill, he's on his deathbed, now the man is quite old, and there's no doubt that, of course, he's aging, and so on and so forth, and maybe struck with illness. But he appeared the following day within Iranian national media, and basically to reassert the fact that, no, he's quite fine. God knows best when his time will come, but whatever they may be, today, tomorrow, the day after, that still leaves us with the dilemmas that I noted, and I will continue to be speaking about. We're also in the moment in which the so-called Iranian nuclear deal is being renegotiated. A great deal of asymmetric warfare is already taking place within the region. We have, in a certain sense, a U.S. Wahhabi, Zionist, Euro-American alliance on the one hand, and a so-called axis of resistance composed of so-called anti-imperialists like China, like Russia, Syria, of course, Hezbollah, Hamas, and so on and so forth, although I'll leave just Hezbollah and Hamas for a moment simply because I consider these to be more movements than they are state-oriented, per se. Parties, although of course Hezbollah has ML, and again, I don't mean to simplify the equation, but these are the false binaries that exist, and this is a geopolitical framing within Islamophobia that is ongoing, within anti-Jewish hate that is ongoing, and an asymmetric warfare. Now comes Allahumma salli ala Muhammad, Mahsa Amini, and what happened with her. A young girl forced to refix by the so-called morality police her hijab, beaten, accounts differ. And this is the way that we need to think, because there's propaganda going on both sides. Fair enough. People then go out to the revolt. And by the way, on the same day, a 15-year-old Iraqi called Zainab Khazali was murdered and was sniped by a U.S. soldier in Iraq. So look at what gets airtime here. Okay. And a wave of uprisings, if you will, begins to take place. Now, mind you, there are also millions of people that are supporting the Iranian regime. And they're out in the streets, and they're equally protesting. Mind you that we had 20 million people that went out for the funeral of Qasem Soleimani. The question becomes now, insofar as Iran, and Iran is a complicated situation because Wilayat al-Faqih, or the Iranian state, was not meant to be a state within itself. It's meant to have expansionary desires, impetus, particularly in relationship to a concept I talk about in the book, where sovereignty lies, which is the ummah, a non-territorial concept, a non-status concept, and so on and so forth. Fair enough. In that particular case, we're seeing patriarchal state repression being pitted against the opposite, quote-unquote, dialectical operative, your American heteropatriarchy, homonationalism, pinkwashing, Islamophobia, on the other side. These are the dynamics that we're seeing. We're seeing this embrace them by some, like actresses, I believe her name was Masih Ali Injadas. I think so. That's how, forgive me for mispronouncing her last name, perhaps. She's an Iranian actress. She left Iran quite a few years ago. Of course, repression, persecution, and so on and so forth. But she's quite been outspoken with regards to the hijab. There are many other Muslim women that have been outspoken with regards to the hijab. As far as I'm concerned, all women, let alone Muslim women, could dress whatever way that they want. That is not the point. The hijab is not the symbol of this or that. It is not the symbol of righteousness or purity or whatever it is. It is and has been taken up as a certain symbol of resistance, certainly in Algeria. When we look at Bill C-51 and 52 bills in the context of Quebec, where women are being banned from the hijab, the same thing in France, and so on and so forth, under the guise of La Cité, which is nothing but a secularized Christian ethic, if you will, that these societies are based on. In this particular instance, nonetheless, we see this Iranian actress who has spoken very openly in her support of Zionists, who has very much praised Mike Pompeo and many, many other secretaries of state and secretaries of war in the U.S. Put out statements. The New York Times writes this article claiming that she is the point person, the leader of this Iranian uprising. This is the degree of confluence of a mess, of a schizophrenic mess in which we live. Now, let me ask to my kin who are on the streets in Iran, as I did of my kin who are on the streets in Egypt, let alone the Black Spring uprisings, as Robin G. J. Kelly refers to them insofar as Black Lives Matter. What are the alternatives here? Because I'm not opposed to direct action. Hell, I participated in a lot of direct actions over the course of my life and on the front lines. In the context of Egypt, where I've had friends that died, friends that have been sniped, because in Egypt, when they, or at least in the global south, when they point their guns at you, they're not using simulated weapons. They're not using blanks. They're using live ammunition. And they shoot for your eyes to blind you, to cripple you, to debilitate you, to disable you. Okay. Besides a direct action, which, again, street protests serve as a cathartic moment of revolt, legitimately so, what are you building as an alternative? What is your plan as an alternative? What are you creating? Or do you simply want to see the downfall of the Iranian state, as you did in Syria? Because one thing revolutionaries need to also determine, beyond the fact of alternatives, the real blood that is shed, and decolonization is inherently violent act, as Fanon teaches. There is no escaping that. It's violent at the level of identity. It's violent at the level of its ruthlessness. One thing that we don't think through is strategy versus tactics. Now, I'm very much against the Butcher of Damascus insofar as Bashar al-Assad. Absolutely. And I stand with my kin. But again, my kin did not learn from the previous kin so far as what happened in Egypt and what happened in Tunis, and Tunis is still a mess. Okay, in that particular instant, and if we're speaking about a revolution, then we need to also understand that at this moment, if you ask me with regards to Syria, I would say absolutely not. No, because the consequence in Syria would be, let's break Syria into different territories. The Sunni, the Shiite, the Kurdish, and so on. Same thing with Iraq. Something that is unacceptable to me. So what's the plan here? It doesn't mean that I condone Bashar al-Assad, me saying this in this particular moment. It means that the Qataris, the Wahhabi Salafis from Saudi Arabia, Turkey, the Muslim Brotherhood, Israel that was treating a lot of front fighters, Jabhat al-Sham now, as they refer to themselves, and so on and so forth, on the battlefield to return them to Syria, need to be taken into consideration by my so-called revolutionary project that I wish to see happen. So my problem is the fact that a lot of people in the West, in the Orientalist West, are fetishizing what they see elsewhere. Take the many white anarchists that go and join our Rojava brothers and sisters insofar as the fight with the Kurds. Tell me, are there not enough monsters within US empire that you would have to go to a region that you know very little about? Why didn't you simply stay here? And that's because you can't face the monster in the mirror. What about the ongoing indigenous genocide? What about the afterlife slavery project society? Your Hartman referred to it in the context of the very space in which you live. But this is Orientalism. So unfortunately, folks have not learned from what has been going on. And I would argue Sudan the same, and it stretches across the board. Unless one has, and again, we don't have to have all the answers, but you have to have a beginning from which you are beginning to lay down a foundation. I don't remember, again, and especially if we're talking about moving beyond liberalism and progressivism. And again, the liberalism is the Hillary Clinton, Obama, and so on type of politics, representational politics, but I also include progressives in that mix too, insofar as the AUC squad crowd, Omar, Rashida Tlaib, and so on and so forth. That isn't sufficient because you're still buying and building and assimilating and working off the fruits of labor for which the settler state, settler colonialism as a structure is functioning, and you're allowing it to ongo and to continue. And at the expense of whom, might I ask? There's no way whereby Ilhan Omar would be flanked by Angela Davis and begins her speech where she says, this is a country founded on slavery, on genocide, but look at me, I made the example of the American dream. So what do my kin in Iran want? They want the fantasy of the American dream that doesn't really exist. They want the secular democratic state that doesn't exist? That becomes the question.
Well, thank you for that overview of the situations. And also, I think, I mean, you touch on a lot of the ideas from the book that I want to like dig a little bit deeper in. Listening to that, though, I just like am thinking about this line from June Jordan's essay Report from the Bahamas, where she says, like, after we get rid of the monsters, we may all want to run in different directions, which I think is really mm-hmm. the ultimate, like, test for so-called revolutionaries, because it's really hard not to want to or imagine that you have some answer or a better way of doing it and impose that on other people. And then there's the like coming down, sort of like what you spoke about, is like there's a cathartic moment within a street protest or that involves direct action, could be violent or whatever. There's something that happens there that like seems like the seed of the revolution, but it doesn't have the sort of, I don't know, the material kind of continuity that would lead to a new world. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of like a place that I feel like we're stuck in rehashing in various places. But I also think that you're quite right thinking about whatever the, you know, settler anarchists in the US aren't facing here when they talk about other struggles elsewhere. Like, I think about this a lot in terms of like Israel, Palestine, and the way that that gets talked about, you know, and there is ongoing indigenous resistance in Turtle Island. And yet, like the way like settler anarchists talk about Israel doesn't sort of face their own complicity within our situation here on this
land. And settlers, as you noted, Scott, I mean, the thing with settlers, white settlers in particular, look at the complicity is not only within the context of settler colonialism, anti-indigenous and anti-black, because certainly, I mean, there's a lot to be said with regards to that. But the complicity is also in imperialism. So there's a double responsibility there. You know, I'm glad that you obviously brought up June Jordan, Fanon. The problem of the hegemony of hegemony or a new elite class that would exercise, you see, it's very easy from a Marxist-Leninist perspective to take over institutions as opposed to construct alternatives, because then you have to think through, because, well, the institution represents that alternative that you're supposedly going to engage in some cleansing act with regards to, although it's going to be hierarchical, yada, yada, yada. And reproduce a lot of authoritarian tendencies within itself, and so on and so forth. But this becomes a challenge because, as you just noted, decolonization is material. It has to deal with land. It is not a metaphor. It doesn't have to deal with dealing with school curriculums, decolonizing the academy, which is a colonial institution, decolonizing laws that are based on Protestant ethic, and so on and so forth. You can't decolonize what is colonially been established insofar as a governance, insofar as a mode of predatory, parasitic, I don't want to even say economic exchange, because there's a difference within our cultures and traditions insofar as markets and fair exchange versus capitalism and what capitalism actually is. There's only integrated worldwide capitalism. And I'm sorry, like China, Russia, Cuba, nobody is exempt from that capitalist market, be it through development, be it through tourist industry. Sure, some are more of a planned economy manifestation than others, but all societies are capitalist. And that is the limitation of thinking within that status framework to enact that change. What becomes necessary, or the choice is either one of two, you either invest in the dominant order or completely divest from it. Divesting means you need to organize. You need to organize the alternatives. You get to know people, which is very difficult within itself because of insecurities, because of fears, because of misconceptions that we've internalized, stereotypes, asymmetries of power that exist amongst us, and what happens if we fail. And the difficulty and challenges of actually creating common communities, solidarities, in which people are not tied together by some kind of national identity or some religious or racial belonging, but rather the ethical and political commitments that inform, that should have identified, that should have come with the identities that they embrace. Queer. Somebody telling me that they're queer means absolutely nothing to me. You're an anarchist or a Muslim. What are the ethical political commitments that defines your queerness, your Islam, your anarchism? Because there are a lot of Zionist queers, let alone anarchists, let alone Muslims, as a matter of fact. So what are the ethical political commitments? It's not a matter of bending oneself or one's body to the sky five times a day as a Muslim when one is being a patriarch, a misogynist to their family, to their wife, yet is okay of looking at a white woman in predominantly non-Muslim society and being able to say, oh, hello back. But when it comes to a Muslim woman, oh, I'm not going to say salam alaikum because I need to supposedly lower my gaze. Right. So this is the kind of hypocrisy, unfortunately, that is very much ongoing. This hypocrisy also stretches in the context of migrant settlers of color, of which a lot are Muslims. Absolutely. Right. And they go out in the streets and it's free, free Palestine. What about us being Zionist or tantamount to being Zionist on the stolen land? Because we reap the privileges. And sorry, there's an incommensurability between, as far as I'm concerned, and this is what the book posits, Islam, certainly, and the world or that is constructed within the context of the settler colony itself in terms of values or cultures of whiteness, which we've all internalized. So to me, whiteness even extends beyond the color of skin. There are white Arabs. There are all kinds of white people that are also people of color. That's not the point. So thinking about the work that we have to do internally and collectively, the calling out mechanisms, because again, if we're talking about building community, that's very, very tough and difficult. We're going to have very difficult conversations as to what binds us, what makes us different, and how do we support one another and what it is that we're building in the first place. So.
Yeah, I mean, pulling on some of this and then getting into one of the main arguments of your book, I want to pull on this idea of decolonization and decolonial education as a main sort of force in this. Because when you sort of start the book out in this kind of false choice between the two different kinds of like Muslim identity, let's say, that is sort of created both by Islamophobia and a long history of Orientalism and colonialism and the reaction to that within certain Muslim, you know, spaces. And I think this speaks to what you were talking about how we end up recreating the hierarchies and institutions. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that dichotomy between the kind of liberal Muslim, you know, who's looking for inclusion in the Euro nation state and the reactionary fundamentalist, infantilized by Islamophobia.
Well, you and I know colonialism is violence. Before I come to recognize my name, the value of my name, my own traditions, my own cultures, my own language, I can fetishize a skin that ain't my own, right? I learned to bleach my skin white because I want to look white. I want to appear white. I want to take on the civilizational values insofar as the dress code. I'm talking surface and depth here, at the level of the superficial surface, the maps on our faces, et cetera, et cetera. But also the eyes insofar as the windows of the soul and the depth insofar as our values. Because of that trauma, because of the hundreds of years of dispossession, literally so, that we have been very much ongoing through, I would argue really since 1492, not just in the context, and of course, you know this, not in the context of just the US and Canada, and so far as, well, actually the conquistador invasion of the Americas in general, starting with the Caribbean, and the significance of that date and why